He's been called the latest in a long line of quintessential American voices. He was called just that, in fact, by People magazine the summer after his second book hit the streets. In an earlier incarnation, he was an independent building contractor, Plain Tom Baudette from Homer, Alaska. Today, he has four books to his credit, a pretty successful little radio show behind him, and, one might suppose, an eternally grateful motel chain singing his praises in three-part harmony. This is Conversations for KUAC-FM. I'm your host, Susan McInnes, and I hope you'll join me for the next hour with the man from the end of the road, author Tom Baudette. I expect it's a bit daunting to be called quintessential at 35 or 36 years old. What's your response to being compared to Mark Twain and Garrison Keillor?
Well, I never want to fall into the trap of believing my own publicity, so I take it all with a grain of salt. I find it very flattering when my name is mentioned in the same breath as those as Garrison Keillor or Will Rogers, Mark Twain, some of the others I've been compared to, but I don't think it's particularly accurate, because that implies some sort of influence or some sort of school of thought, I think. And I'd be much more accurately compared to the likes of Bob Doris or Tim Venichuk or maybe John Bushell, who are people you've never heard of. These are buddies of mine, people I've known all my life. I grew up with them. I see them every day. I've worked with them, fought with them, played with them, and them and 100 others. And that's my influence. You know, if I belong to any school, it is that that camaraderie that I've enjoyed with my close friends and family over the years. Because I've never really been a student of literature and letters to speak of. I studied a little bit in college, but it bored me to tears, college did, and I quit after about 18 months of misery and came out west to do something with myself. And when I started writing 6 years ago, is all it's been, I did it because it was fun and it was local. I was just doing down KBBI there in Homer. And I never wanted anything out of it, and I've always been very surprised as it has continued to grow and become this, which to me is uncanny, has attracted this uncanny attention, because I still do it because I like it, and I hope that never goes away, because I don't know if I'll ever be satisfied with another job. This one's too easy.
Did you think about writing before you started to write?
Yeah, I did. That's what I wanted to do when I was in college. And in high school, I did a lot of writing, and I got a lot of good attention from my high school teachers. But then when I got to college and started to study the form and try to write serious, and I was very impressed with the likes of James Joyce and Ezra Pound, and I was reading these sorts of gentlemen, and trying to write like them, and I realized that I was a 19-year-old kid with nothing in my head but a handful of bad ideas, and none of which would pan out, and I realized I didn't have anything to say. I hadn't done anything, and I started seeing myself and all of my classmates, too, and are these self-important 19-year-olds with these great, grand ideas, and I realized we were all wet, that there was wasn't happening for me there, and the best advice I got is, I used to write these horrible stories, these very impressionistic sort of stream of consciousness things. They were just awful. And I had this wonderful writing professor, a guy named Albert Drake, who is still a friend of mine. And I'd hand in these stories to him, along with about a two-page letter of explanation, basically a letter of apology for these things. And one day, about 3 months into the semester, he called me in his office and for one of our meetings, and he says, "Tom, you know, God, your stories suck." He says, "But your letters are great." He says, "Why don't you write like you talk and think instead of this stuff, and you'll do fine." And it was in that conversation I told him I was thinking of leaving school. I says, "God, this place just drives me nuts, you know." And he says, "I think you should." You know, here's a writing professor, a college professor, instructing a student to leave. And I was gone within 2 weeks. I quit right in the middle of the semester and headed out to Oregon and figured that if I was going to write about anything, I'd have to do something. And I so much wanted to be a part of the real world, the working world. And I always admired working people who drove trucks and chopped logs and did things. I just liked people who did things, and and I wanted to do things. So I did. That's what brought me to Alaska, was the continuation of that wanderlust. And I fished and logged and ended up in the building trades, built many houses over the years. And I don't know if I got that out of my system or just what happened, but it wasn't like I was a frustrated writer all those years. I was actually a fairly contented house builder. Mm-hmm. But one day I just started writing again, and all of a sudden I did have some things to say. I didn't even realize it. And they were simple things, not the things I thought I would have to say at all. It's not Ezra Pound and James Joyce, as you see. It's much, right. It's much different than that.
The boy looked for Hemingway and found Baudet.
Yeah.
Yeah. The story goes that you were in a grocery store, and somewhere between your checkbook and your desire for a pack of cigarettes, you came up short of change, and that was the first thing that was published, was your story about not having money for smokes and trying to give up smoking.
Yeah, that was that was a bad point in my career, actually. just realized one day, you know, it's one of those things where you live in hand to mouth, and it's just one of those days of the week that there wasn't even enough money for a pack of smokes. I said, well, honey, good time to quit. And I think I wrote that piece just to keep my hands busy more than anything else, and just to get it off my mind, you know, joking about what you go through from nicotine withdrawal. And when it was done, I liked it. I said, that's kind of cute. And I showed it to Debbie, my wife. And We Alaskans, which is the Anchorage Daily News, the Sunday magazine, has a little forum. I think it's called General Delivery, where people from around the state, just amateur writers and letter writers, can show their stuff. And I thought I'd seen worse things than that in there. So I sent it to them thinking, wouldn't that be cool? And they printed it, and of course I could have gotten hit by a bus and just died happy right there, my writing career having just gone farther than I ever figured it would. And Eileen Hughes down at KBBI there in Homer, the news director, read it and thought that something like that would make a neat little radio spot, radio comment. And she had at the time been looking for some way to get some local voices involved with the news. And she asked if I wouldn't mind doing stuff like that on a weekly basis. And I thought, I don't know. I had never been in front of a microphone before. And I says, what would I write about? And she says, just whatever's going on in your life, you know. What did you do today? And I said, well, I had my dog castrated. And she says, well, that could be fun. Write that up. And
not to the dog.
Yeah, so I did. And that was my very first broadcast piece, was a piece about having my dog fixed. And then the next week, I went commercial halibut fishing with a friend, so I wrote about that. And then the week after, there was always seemed to be something there. And APRN picked them up and started airing them. And again, it could have all stopped right then, and I would have been content that I'd accomplished even that. And then we sent a tape down to NPR, to All Things Considered, and they liked them and said, yeah, send more. And so I ended up with them weekly for, oh gosh, about 2.5 years, I guess. And of course, that's when it all really started to come together for me. That's where the publishing house in Boston, my first publisher, Addison Wesley, one of their editors, was hearing me on All Things Considered and thought that they'd make a nice collection. And we think they did. And then we signed another collection. And about 2 years into the NPR stint, the ad agency in Dallas that was handling the Motel 6 account was just creating a new radio campaign. And one of their writers was a fan from NPR and thought that I had the sort of style and personality that would work with what they had in mind. And, of course, once that hit the air, the audience numbers in commercial radio are just astounding. Where NPR, has 360-some member stations, and those commercials air on like 4,000 stations on a weekly basis. And so all of a sudden my name was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that was a little startling, quite scary, actually. And I struggled with it for a while, thinking, God, I never signed on to be the Motel 6 man. I wanted to be a writer here. All of a sudden, I'm trying to take myself seriously as a writer, and I've gotten this sidetrack. But what that served to accomplish is it made me somewhat financially secure, so I was able to work more with my writing. And I left NPR and left the short-form stuff and started writing longer things, fiction, which is terribly hard to publish. The fiction in the publishing world is very competitive. And because of the notoriety I was gaining from Motel 6, my new publisher, William Morrow, was willing to take a chance on a collection of my fiction. So they signed for The End of the Road. And that worked out very well for them, and now now we've got The Big Garage on Clear Shot, which is more of that. So everything just sort of happened on top of the thing that came before, and again, I haven't solicited any of it. It just seemed to fall right in my lap. It's almost embarrassing to talk to other writers sometimes about it, because I don't know what I ever did to deserve this.
No Garrett to talk about. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Conversations on KUAC-FM, and the voice you've been hearing, probably familiar to you, is the voice of Tom Beaudet. He's mentioned in passing some of the things he's been doing. The first book that came out was As Far As You Can Go Without a Passport, subtitled The View from the End of the Road. It was published in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And its publisher was Addison Wheely Publishing Company. It was followed by Small Comforts in 1987, Small Comforts being more comments and comic pieces from Tom Beaudet. The two fiction books, The End of the Road, came out in 1989, followed hard on this year by The Big Garage on Clear Shot, which came out in October of 1990. This is Tom Beaudet. Were there storytellers in your family?
No, not really. My mom is a real motor mouth. I don't know that she necessarily constructs stories, but she always is talking. And my dad has a very dry and very, I think, good sense of humor. So I think somewhere between those two genetic mixes mm-hmm. is probably where I at least got the gift of gab. And the storytelling part of it, I don't really know. I don't know a lot about form and format as far as the short story is concerned. I approach them very blindly. I just kind of start a story. And the way I approach writing fiction is when I started to work on this series, which was for the radio show, The End of the Road, mm-hmm. The first thing I did is I created all my characters first. And I wrote huge profiles on each one of them so that I knew everything about them. That Argus Winslow grew up in southern Idaho, and that his father died when he was 12, and he took over the responsibilities of the family, and he was always a little bitter. And all these things that I just, to create these people. And that Tamara Dupree grew up in a logging family but was frustrated by the whole environment, went to college at Berkeley and became a tremendous environmental activist and New Age devotee. And I would have all these little secrets that my characters have that aren't really revealed in the in many of the stories. But it was my way of giving them all a distinct voice. And I worked months on that. And what that served to do for me is the stories write themselves. All I have to do is put Ed Flanagan and Tamara Dupree in a room together, and something happens. I mean, it just... The situation doesn't have to be anything grand at all. It doesn't have to be a great plot or anything. These two characters just start working on each other.
Sure.
And it's very fun to do. It's very fun to work with these people. And more, I think I'm going schizophrenic because I'm starting to think of them as people. They're almost like my imaginary friends that you used to have when you were children.
Yeah, not surprised. Would you read from the newest book, The Big Garage on Clear Shot?
Yeah.
Again, this is out in October of 1990, fresh off the presses.
Yeah, well, I'll read Good Place Starts at the Beginning, I guess. I'll read the introduction here, which is written by my imaginary friend Ruby McClay, who has lived at the end of the road for about 35 years, if I remember correctly. She says, "I remember when the big garage on Clear Shot still had trucks in it. That first Orange City snowplow and the fire truck used to sit there side by side. Young Ed Flanagan would come in to wax and polish them. He'd listen to the stories going on around the coffee pot, rub on the trucks, and wait to grow old enough to run 'em. Well, those seemed like simple times around here. Not that they're very darn complicated now, but there seemed to be less fussing. If you were one to have your coffee with a little conversation in the morning, You'd be down at the big garage like I was, sitting on oil cans or leaned up against doorways, talking about the same things over and over. Young Ed's eye for equipment. Argus Winslow and Bud Koenig's latest feud. What's going on with the new water line? Who got rich fishing and who went broke trying? There weren't so many kinds of people here then, but there were still plenty of stories to tell, and as new people came in, the stories got better and the town got bigger, and we've all grown out of that coffee pot in the back of the big garage on Clearshot. When the mayor's sister opened up Clara's coffee cup, that was pretty much the end of the powwows down at the garage. The city built itself a fancy new city hall some years back with a shop and fire hall, and all the trucks have long been moved over there. Most of us old-timers head down to Clara's in the morning now, but that doesn't mean it's the only campfire in the woods anymore. This town's grown up, and there's lots of little corners in it now. Tamara Dupree and her gang over at the Natural Food Coop carved themselves out a fine little niche to sit in. Pastor Frank's flock up at the First and Last Baptist Church hang together pretty well. The organization of Fishermen's Wives seems to keep busy enough, and between all of this and all the new faces, it's a wonder we find a chance to get together at all. I guess what I like best about this town is that we do find the time and reasons to get together, and no matter what camp you come from, whether you just fell off the truck or been here all your life, everybody's equally welcome. And I think the nicest part of it all, and the reason I brought the whole thing up, is that the only place in town big enough to hold us when we do decide to get together is still the big garage on Clearshot. Whether it's two-stepping at a square dance or chewing somebody's ear off at a town meeting, the big garage is the one place in town where everybody feels at home. It's different now than it was when there were trucks in it and it was just us few. Ed's a man now. The oil cans have become folding chairs and the coffee pot now serves 50. But there still seems plenty to talk about. There's other young ones to watch and old ones to consider. Each new person brings us a new story, and there's times down there when I'm leaned into a doorway listening to us yammer that it sounds just like the old days. Doesn't make me miss them, though. I like these stories as well as the ones we used to tell over and over and over.
Tom Baudet reading from his latest book, The Big Garage, on Clearshot, Life at the End of the Road. You write vignettes, it seems to me, whether it's the commentaries in Small Comforts or either of the books about the end of the road, short pieces that give you a bit of a glimpse into something that's going on. Don't tell the whole story. Something like Doug McDougan's carvings out of driftwood, Doug McDougan being one of the characters in the book.
Yeah, Doug is probably my alter ego. And funny enough, he didn't start off to be. I created Doug to be actually sort of my villain. I wanted to have one obnoxious character that nobody liked.
The liar and the antisocial.
Right. He's a liar and a cheat and a braggart, and he's illiterate and stupid, and there was just nothing likable about the character that I started with. Mm-hmm. But I suffer from what they call the Graham Greene syndrome, where I'm unable to invent a unsympathetic character. And as I worked a little bit with Doug, I had to bring something lovable out. And what emerged was that he discovered he had a propensity for carving. He'd always carved. He lived on the beach in this old driftwood shack, and he'd see pieces of driftwood washed up, and they would remind him of animals he'd seen, foxes and bears and whales and beaver and things, and he would see them so clearly that he'd take out his jackknife and just doctor them up a little bit is what he felt he was doing so he could see it clearly. And then he'd, you know, basically just leave them lay, let them wash out with the next tide. And then this mysterious blue-haired lady appears. She was a Anchorage art gallery owner, and she's down on the beach one day, and she runs across Doug whittling away on one of these things, and she's just so impressed with what she sees. It's sort of this vision that he had, and he had no idea of his abilities, and he had about six or eight of these things laying around. She paid him $1,000 to take them all, and offered him $200 a piece for anything more that he would do, and she took him up to Anchorage, polished him up, put him in her art gallery. Well, one thing leads to another. The next thing Doug knows is that he's an artist, and And he hasn't the faintest idea of what it's about, what the big deal's about, because he's just doing something that he always did on his own, and he doesn't understand what the attraction is. And what's funny about it is, obviously, this seems to be a great parallel to my own personal feelings about what's happened to me, but I didn't know I was doing it when I was writing those things. And I find then, once I realized that I was doing that, I started looking at some of the other stories that I was doing and find out that most of my personal issues were being worked out and in the guise of my characters. And then I started to understand what it is that drives me and maybe any artist to write or create in any way is just that urge to get it out of you, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it's very comforting.
Do you feel yourself changing in the process of writing and creating characters?
Yeah.
Do you work enough out of Doug that you see something new in yourself?
Yeah, I do. And it isn't so much that I see new in myself as I keep seeing into... I keep being able to see other people more clearly as I write deeper into these characters. As I work with them over this period of years, I got much more intimate with them, and before I would write dialogue, I would have to think very... I was probably taking it too seriously at some point. Think very seriously about exactly what would Tamara say here, and why would she say it, and how would she say it, and I realized that what I was doing was developing a tremendous sense of empathy for other people's points of view. And since that's happened, you can't hardly make me mad anymore. And it's uncanny. I always I'm sort of a confrontative personality by nature and by history, but now when someone's telling me their point of view, and I don't care if it's completely opposite from mine, however obnoxious it's being presented, I can understand where it's coming from, and it's okay with me. And it's almost like what Will Rogers used to say: "He never met a man he didn't like." And I'm starting to feel that way these days. Is that people have become so fascinating to me and so genuine that I can't hardly find a rotten egg anymore.
How'd you hit on the vignette? Was it just because you needed to create short pieces for radio?
Well, when I started off with public radio, yeah, they were looking for around 3-minute pieces, and that seemed real comfortable. Then when I started writing for the Daily News, they want a little longer pieces. 3 minutes is what, about 600 words. They wanted more like 1,000, 1,200 words. So that was took a little getting used to. You had to sort of draw an idea out a little more, support it a little better, and I got used to that, and I enjoyed that very much. And then with the stories, I had 20 minutes to do a story. None of these stories vary more than about 400 words in length, and I never thought I'd be able to do that, but it was amazing how it happened. As each week, as I'd have to write the next episode, always when I'd get on about, it's about 10 pages, these stories are, I'd get on about page 7.5, and the ending would just present itself, and it would just come around. So I don't know where all that happens. It's one of those things, I don't really want to get my hands on it for fear it'll fall apart between my fingers. You know?
Well, the reason I wondered is that many authors, many writers say that the short story is the hardest thing they do, that the second hardest thing to poetry.
Yeah, well, writing short is definitely harder than writing long. Writers, like anyone else, like the sound of their own voices. And when you're on a roll, when you really feel the muse, you want to elaborate and metaphor and simile and make it all just so beautiful. And because, you know, writers are wordsmiths. We like to work with words just like woodworkers like to work with wood, and you don't want to stop doing it. But it's tough to write short, but I like it because I like having to be concise like that. And I never really start a story until I'm pretty sure that I can end it. I know all of my stories sort of start off with the point of the whole thing. Here's one that they happen to print out on the jacket. This is the start of a story called Ruby and Argus. Says young love may well be the most overrated phenomenon since the disposable diaper. No matter how nice it seems looking back on it all, it was still an ugly business. And that pretty much says what the story's about. These are grown people falling in puppy love, and they're going to rediscover all over again that young love really is not all it's cracked up to be. It's quite painful.
And even if you're 60, it's got sweaty palms and not knowing what to wear and all
right.
the other problems that
right.
go with it. Sure. Right. This is Tom Baudette, the author of 4 books now. Had a little radio show going for about 18 months, we figure.
Yeah, just about that. I think
called The End of the Road.
We did 70 programs of that.
Both commercial and public radio aired it over that amount of time. He's also, if you haven't figured it out yet, if your brain is searching for why this voice is familiar, he also tells you that he'll leave the light on for you. He's the voice of Motel 6. If you take the word folklore and break it down, you get folk lore, people's knowledge. These days, few people see themselves as common folk, and we're not sure we really share the same knowledge as our neighbors, much less the folk across town. Folklore seems like something we've left in the dust of a fast-moving and changing culture. This is Conversations for KUAC-FM, and I'm your host, Susan McGinnis. Today, on a return visit, we talk to a man who has devoted his life to the study of the people's knowledge. Dr. Barry Tolkien is a professor of English and history at Utah State University and the director of the folklore program at Utah State. In the next hour, we'll take a look at American folklore, and we'll turn later in the hour to ballads and see what they say about culture. Folk isn't the simple word it appears to be. On the one hand, it just means people we know. I had the folks over for dinner last night, or you'll like them, they're just plain folk. On the other hand, folk exhumes some long-buried, sturdy present stock, an unsophisticated bunch, the simple folk, people our culture has left behind. Dr. Tolkien, is my read on that right? Do we have kind of a peculiar and ambiguous relationship with that word, folk?
I think we do. I think the word itself means several different things anyway, and as you've pointed out, we use it in different ways. In fact, the early folklorists used the word in a special way to mean a kind of a rural folk of the sort where a village or a neighborhood or a district might have a lot in common, where there might be either an ethnic identity or a regional identity or a local dialect or something like that that captured everybody together, so to say, in a single group, and you could call them the folk, you know, as if they were somehow different from some other folk. And in fact, in German today, the word das Volk is used in that way. It's almost like our word ethnic group. Mm-hmm. And so it means a group of people with a lot of shared identity for many people. The thing is that in the passage of time, what we realize is that not only have we changed a lot in the way we live and identify ourselves, but we know now that there are lots of different groups of folk, and if you can subdivide human beings almost endlessly in terms of their family connections or their ethnic backgrounds or their gender or their occupation, their region, and so on. And most of us belong to several identifiable groupings. So that's one big shift in the recent years. We now realize we're not just talking about country folks who have some kind of a single community, but we're talking about any kind of reasonable grouping of humans who share something beyond the coincidental. I mean, it's not like a group of people on the bus heading for Buffalo, New York or something, because that doesn't last long enough. But a group that retains something over time is usually thought of as some kind of a folk. And in fact, most of us wish today we had a better word for that kind of group. I mean, you can call it a subgroup or a sociological XYZ subsystem, or, you know, there are ways of naming it, but they get more and more complex. And I think most of us would like a simple everyday word that would mean essentially what you pointed out first, that is ordinary people as compared to unique people who come to our attention separately. The gang, the aggregate, and
right.
most of us belong to several aggregates. You know, when you think of yourself as a unique person, you're separate from your family. But when you get together for a family reunion or for Christmas dinner or something, then you're thinking of yourself as part of a larger group, and that group would be a for our purposes, a folk group, a group that identifies itself with language or custom or some other network of things that, that the members hold in common.
As we then acknowledge that there are a lot of different folks and folk groups, then it makes sense that we have a lot of different lores as well.
Sure.
It's no longer a simple issue of what the people know.
It's it used to be the notion that that rural people somehow held on to older esoteric knowledge from primitive times, and perhaps they did. In fact, we have a lot of folk cures and so on that must go back to very primitive times. A lot of our folklore is very ancient. But what really makes folk groups tick today is not so much their antiquity, but their dynamics as groups. And most of us, as I say, belong to several of those. And so, for example, if you're a logger, if you're a man and a logger, and say a Mormon, and you live in, say, Washington, state of Washington, you're going to have several different kinds of lores. You're going to be using a language among your fellow loggers that you would never use at home with your family. You're going to be talking among the men in the way you don't talk among the women. You're going to be telling jokes in one place that you wouldn't tell in the other, that sort of thing. Songs may be sung at home that you would feel foolish singing on the job. And if you're a Mormon, and I mention that because in church then you're sharing a lot of lore and attitude and terminology with other Mormons that wouldn't have anything to do with living in Oregon or wouldn't have anything to do with being a logger. And then your family might have still different customs because maybe they all came from England or Northern Germany or something like that. So when you get together for Christmas, you're not being a logger or a Mormon or a a person from Washington or Oregon, but you're being a member of the Blatz family or something like that. So I think we have several shared identities like that. And folklore is the means by which we communicate with those meaningful groups.
And in this time, in this place, for a folklorist, this must be a veritable harvest culture.
Oh, sure it is, yeah. Well, Alaska, for example, would be a circus for a folklorist because you've got so many cultures here and so many intense connections among groups of people, members of groups of occupations, for example. And, of course, you get not only the lore of the group, but you get the lore of the outsiders. For example, there was a lot of Alaska lore about the Texans and the Oklahomans who came up as workers on the oil line, for example. You had a lot of what we call exoteric folklore, outsiders folklore about other insiders in other groups. And where I live now in Utah, similarly, it's a bountiful place to study folklore because you have people who use their religious connections as the basis for a lot of their stories and their jokes and their terminology, words they use or don't use. Mormons, for example, are encouraged not to swear, not to use profanity. And so they have a lot of substitute swear words. Oh, my heck, for example, is something you hear a lot. And taken by itself, a single term like that doesn't tell you much. But when you get a whole aggregate of terms or terms that are being used or avoided or foods used or avoided or stories being told to illustrate in the everyday arena something that's happening on that has a religious meaning. I mean, you get the same kinds of stories among Jews and among Catholics. I mean, Catholic people tell jokes about having been in parochial school and so on. I mean, almost anything you've shared intensely on a religious basis or regional basis will be reflected in folklore. So there's more and more work for folklorists. Folklore isn't disappearing. The old stereotype was that it would die out as we all became literate and sensible people. But if anything, we now think there's more folklore than ever because we have more intensely conscious groups of people.
You said in passing the other day when I was listening to you that you see more and more America as a country that sees itself as not having a culture. I'm interested in that coming from the lips of a folklorist.
Well, I think it's a conception that's largely untrue, but it's a conception that's widespread. You'll hear Americans say, oh, well, we don't have any American culture. We don't share anything nationwide.
What do we mean when we say that?
Well, I'm not sure what people mean. I think what they're doing is comparing themselves to people like Japanese or Germans who seem to have a lot of customs, let's say, that all Germans or all Japanese seem to know. I've just finished doing a study of Japanese ghost stories, and it's true. You can some of these stories are so widely known. You can tell them anywhere in Japan, and everybody's heard them. Even a modern Tokyo taxi driver will have heard there's a particular ghost story about a woman who shows up in a taxi, and all the taxi drivers I've talked to have heard it. And then when you say that to an American, they'll say, gee, it's too bad we don't have folklore like that. It's too bad we don't have a custom that everybody knows about. But in fact, we do. I mean, it's their conception that we don't, but who is there who hasn't participated in an American birthday party, for example? Who knows? Is there somebody who doesn't know what you're supposed to eat for Thanksgiving dinner? It has nothing to do with whether turkey is your favorite food. It has to do with a custom. And it's not an old custom. It's only about 30 or 40 years old, eating turkey at Thanksgiving time. Hard to find an American. Well, I'm excluding here the most recent immigrants, let's say, from Southeast Asia or from other countries, but say an American who's been in an American family for a number of years, no matter what color or background, it's hard to find an American who can't finish little nursery rhymes like Star Light, Star Bright, or Rain, Rain, Go Away, things like that. They seem childish, but when you think of it, just think of how many people could finish that song. Or if you say Rockabye Baby, how many people can finish it? Or if you're at a party and suddenly a cake comes out and somebody sings, ha, everybody in the room knows how to finish that song. Mm-hmm. And so we share a lot of things, but they tend to be the things, I think, today that we experience in common.
But we take them for granted.
And we take them for granted. They're so common that we don't pay any attention to them, see? And that's it's what some people have called the triviality barrier. There's the notion that if it's very common, it can't be very important. And what the folklorist does, as does the social historian, for example, is take exactly the opposite point of view. If it's common, then it must be important. Otherwise, how would it have become common?
But you know, it never gets into the history books.
No, it doesn't, because it's not unique enough. And in fact, that's one of the problems with history books, and historians are trying to deal with that. They've often used materials drawn from the unique people. Well, you can also make it a status difference. The elite people, the people who leave a lot of papers after them when they die, you know, the leaders, the George Washingtons, the generals, and so on. And we have virtually ignored or simply have not been interested in the expressions of the everyday person, which we would call the folk, you know, everyday perhaps, or vernacular is another word for it. It doesn't mean just the poor folks or the rural folks, but what does anybody in a given time frame in a given culture think or feel about things? And the way you study that is not by going through the papers of famous persons, but you study what's going around at a given time. In America, you'd have to study the jokes. I mean, Americans tell jokes practically all the time. You can't go to a sit-down dinner without hearing the after-dinner speaker start with a couple of jokes. You go to a cocktail party, it's jokes. And jokes have become, for anthropologists and folklorists and, again, social historians, some of the best barometric readings on what's going on in the shared emotional lives of the everyday people in a culture. No matter from what level of the culture you draw them from, they're all telling jokes.
Is that peculiarly American, or do other cultures also?
No, other cultures do it.
It's their jokes representing their culture and lore, and our jokes representing ours.
If you could, just take an example that's current. If you could have spent the last, say, 10 or 20 years in Eastern Europe listening to jokes, what you would have found out was that almost all their jokes were about politics, some aspect of politics. Sometimes very corrosive aspects. I mean, they're really sarcastic jokes. It was one of the only ways they had of expressing themselves about the realities. Shortages of food, for example, a very typical joke in East Germany a few years ago was, to ask a visitor, have you seen our new banana automats? And you'd have to say, no, what's the story on that? Oh, yeah, they have them all over the place. Now, if you stick a banana in, you'll get 20 marks. Not very funny to an American, but if you're living in a country where there are no bananas, what it says is if you had a banana, you could use it for currency. You know?
Right.
And it's funny to them because they had no bananas. And what did they do? When the Berlin Wall went down, one of the things that all those people flooded into were the markets, and they bought fresh fruits that they hadn't seen for years. Well, if anybody had been alive to this, and some people were, by the way, people have been collecting these things, you could have made a profile of almost everything that was going on in the imaginations and the frustrations of the Eastern European peoples by studying their jokes. And what you would now find is that these very themes are being expressed in political terms, conscious terms now, by writers and philosophers and politicians and so on. But this stuff has been there for a pulse reading, so to speak, all along. In our country, we tend to joke about the things that make Americans anxiety-ridden or tense or at least things that are of concern for us. Typical subjects like sex, race, religion. When the first IQ tests started to go around the schools, all the grown-ups began telling moron stories, question and answer jokes about morons. Why did the little moron do this, that, or the other thing? When contraception and abortion became topics of open conversation, which they weren't when I was a kid. Suddenly kids were telling jokes about dead babies and babies being speared and thrown off trucks and so on, and the kids were laughing at them. I think it indicated something they were nervous about. The whole adult world seemed to be talking about what we're going to do with excess kids. You know?
Zero population.
Yeah, zero population.
Does that mean me?
Yeah, does that mean me? What does it mean about attitudes toward kids? And it came. I think the anxiety came out in jokes. During the civil rights period, I think without anybody realizing it, there came out a tremendous range of jokes that we call the elephant jokes, all of which, without us being consciously aware of it, expressed the main themes of the frustrations and threats and fears of civil rights era. The elephant was described as moving in too close to your neighborhood or into your household. You know, how do you know when there's an elephant in your refrigerator, in your bed, in your bathtub? There was the super sexual elephant, a whole range, hundreds of jokes about the how to take sexual power away from an elephant. How do you keep an elephant from stampeding? You cut his stampeder off, that sort of thing. Puns that implied that the elephant was sexually intrusive into your neighborhood. A whole bunch of them about elephants disguising their color, but you and I could still tell they were elephants.
Hiding, painted their toenails pink,
uh-huh. and so on. And those are all the themes of blacks trying to lighten their skin or straighten their hair or moving into the neighborhood or being sexually active and so on. Nobody realized it until afterwards, but it was interesting. Not many blacks were telling the elephant jokes. In fact, a friend of mine who's a folklorist, Kenny Goldstein in Philadelphia, asked his black secretary if she'd heard the latest elephant joke. This is back then. And she listened to it politely, and then she said, "You guys used to call us monkeys. How come you've changed it to elephants?" You know, and apparently a lot of blacks recognized it right away, but most whites didn't. One of the things that happened after the Vietnam War were the disabled veteran jokes. What do you call a guy with no arms and no legs whom you find on your front porch? Did you hear any of those around here? Mm-hmm. Matt. In other words, you try to find a man's name that would describe something. What do you call a guy with no arms and no legs you find on your wall? Art. In your mailbox, Bill. In your swimming pool, Bob. In your hot tub, Stu. And the notion was to, in effect, joke about the appearance in local, personal, intimate places of people no one wanted to acknowledge. You know, and I would think that that's what we were talking earlier about what it is that gives us a kind of a print of ourselves as a culture. Jokes are one of the best examples because they're very, very timely. And they're almost never funny when you think about it. You go back to the elephant jokes, they're not funny anymore. These disabled jokes aren't funny. What was funny about the shuttle disaster jokes? You know, but we were all laughing and groaning at the same time.
So
because we saw a teacher get blown up on TV. You know?
We're adjusting ourselves to something that's frightening.
Yeah.
Makes us anxious, intolerable.
Yeah.
In one way or the other.
In one way or another, I think a joke does several things. I think this is where the triviality factor gets in our way. Jokes are so common that we tend not to take them seriously. But when you look at them, first of all, of course, they entertain us. Otherwise, why tell them? But notice they also let us release in a burst of laughter some sense of nervousness about a topic that is not really very funny, like a shuttle blowing up or about sex or race, which aren't funny subjects. So there's a release of something in the joke that's possible. It also allows you to play with things you're not supposed to play with. You can play around with sex and with disaster and so on. You can re-experience it that way. Maybe by re-experiencing it, you internalize it better. I mean, maybe it's a psychologically positive function as well as a way of retaining something. We still joke about race. People who would claim they're not racists will still tell racially oriented jokes, which means that jokes are a way of being conservative too. You can hang on to some old ideas by pretending to laugh about it. When the Mormon Church,
and I can tell you that story because you and I understand
each other.
You and I
know, yeah,
that
this is only a joke. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was great when the Mormon Church changed its position on blacks holding the priesthood, and there was this tremendous flood of black Mormon jokes that was made up primarily of all the stereotypes anybody had ever heard about blacks. They were going to change the state bird from the seagull to the fried chicken. They were going to pull up the flowers on Temple Square and replace them with watermelons. They were going to replace the statue of Moroni on the temple with a statue of Louis Armstrong, and so on and so on. It was all stereotypical stuff, and people were able to laugh at it by trotting out all these stereotypes that everybody of an intellectual bent would have thought had died 30 years before. But they, you know, these things die very hard. And so one of the things you get with folklore is a kind of an unmasked look at your culture, too. It's not always fun and games when you get into folklore because you have to recognize the bare face of a lot of the old ideas that haven't died out yet. Anti-feminine jokes, for example. A lot of sexual jokes are jokes that feature the dismemberment of females, for example, and we laugh uproariously at them before we take a careful look at what the imagery really says, you know. Mm-hmm. And what it means is that a lot of anti-feminist feeling and perhaps a sense of threat, or rather than disappearing, maybe has been intensified by the women's movement, for example. What it means in folklore terms is that you can expect almost any political movement to have its repercussions on the cultural level, and you're going to hear it in the jokes or in the legends or in the rumors that go around, the songs that are sung. You hear it in popular culture as well, not just in folklore. The stuff that people buy on records will also show this. And not to study this stuff is to be willing to be ignorant about your own culture, I think.
At the very least, you're pulling a curtain over a major window.
Yeah. If you say, oh, I think jokes are just funny, we tell them because we like a good laugh and hoo-ha, who wants to make something? You know, why read a lot of meaning into it? That's a fancy way of saying I don't like to think because these jokes aren't funny. And you can tell them 2 years later and nobody will laugh at them. So if they were absurd and funny, if they are funny because of their absurdity, they should stay funny, but they don't. They're funny because they touch off something that worries people right now. And so it's a great study for right now. If we had a collection of the jokes that were told during the Revolution, we'd know a lot about the American Revolution that we have no idea about now. We know all about George Washington. We know almost nothing about the soldiers who left home and fought the Revolution. And what they're doing in the French Revolution now is they're studying the customs and games and jokes and fads of the working people just before the French Revolution, and they're finding out a tremendous wave of the same themes that came out later in philosophical treatises were already there on the streets in Paris.
In the hands of Madame Lafarge.
Yeah, or in the hands of apprentices in the print shops, for example, who went on a rampage one time and killed all the cats they could find. There's a book about it called The Great Cat Massacre. It became very fashionable for working-level people to kill all the cats in the city.
Because?
Well, the cats represented a number of things, including the cats were often the pampered pets of the owners, and so they represented status differences, among other things. Also in French, as in English, the cat represents female sexuality, and there was a lot in the fads in those days that had to do with male versus female powers during the French Revolution, which is why so many of the female figures come in rather ambiguous roles in the stories about the French Revolution. I mean, tremendous numbers of things going on. And if you only read the documents written by unique political commentators, then all you get are what the intellectual people were thinking about it, and not what the blood and guts of it on the street. The French Revolution, in other words, is the end expression of a tremendous range of things that were going on, not just political.
This is Conversations, and the voice you hear is that of Dr. Barry Tolkien. He is a professor of history and of English at Utah State University, also the director of the folklore program at Utah State, which is at Logan, Utah, as well the director of the graduate program in American Studies. We'll learn more about Dr. Tolkien as we go on through this hour. Today, our subject is folklore and what it tells us about us.